פודקאסט ישראל מדיה מגישה. עושים עסקים עם רן לוי.
Hello and welcome to עושים עסקים. Hello to my guest, Dhiraj Panji.
Hello.
Pandey, yes. Sorry. Yeah. I'll mispronounce your name plenty of times, I'm sure. I'll tell about you to our audience in a second. Let me just remind our audience that in the coming weeks, I'll be gradually replaced by Gil Rosenfeld, CEO of HP Israel, and actually the first guest of this show, Osim Asakim. He's taking over my seat as the host of this show because I'm way too busy being the executive editor of the entire network. So I need to make some changes to balance. Exactly.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. So back to you, Dhiraj, and let me introduce you to the audience. You're the CEO of Nutanix, which is an enterprise cloud firm based in the US. Actually, one of the biggest, or let's say most successful companies, high-tech companies right now, I think, the US. Your IPO in 2016 is considered, I think, to be the biggest IPO of that year, right? It was a great success, and many... media descriptions describe you as a disruptive and innovative company, and in the world of enterprise cloud, being innovative and hailed as disruptive is not easy. We'll talk about it. It's a very difficult segment of the market. Dhiraj is married with three kids. He was born in India, came to the US at what age? 22?
22.
Yeah. We'll talk about it as well. Started out as a software developer and then went on to be a manager in both Oracle and Teradata, what is called now Teradata. And Nutanix was founded in 2009. It is now a company of 2,800 people strong. It's a huge company in Israeli terms, but a relatively smallish company, as you described it earlier, in American terms. So thank you for being here, first of all. It's a great honor to have you here.
My honor, and I'm a pleasure as well.
Thank you. And let's talk about Nutanix, first of all, and describe Nutanix to our listeners who might not be that fluent in what's going on in the enterprise cloud world. What does Nutanix do?
Yeah. So if you look at an analogy of an iPhone and how before the iPhone, our personal lives had all sorts of specialized devices, hardware devices for one thing and one thing only. Mm-hmm. There was a music player, a feature phone, a video camera, a GPS device, and on and on and on, a voice recorder. Everything was a separate single purpose hardware device. And then everything converged on one platform, either iOS or Android. So there were two operating systems that emerged where hardware became pure software. And with convergence came a lot of ease of use kind of experience as well, because now I'm carrying my camera, my video camera, my phone, my PC in some sense, because it can browse the web, my email, pretty much my entire life is now.
Yeah, one small computer replaced table full of consumer devices.
Exactly. 50 to 100x reduction in footprint and real estate. And the fact that these apps are now connected to each other, I go to my calendar app and I click a link and it opens up my GPS app. I don't have to interact with the machine to tell me where I'm headed. So immense disruption in the personal computing just in the last 10 years.
And that's on the iPhone. That's the iPhone analogy and what you're doing.
Yeah. So if you think about the enterprise computing world, you know, when you look at servers and storage and networks, data centers, the whole infrastructure space, this is the underbelly of any enterprise, even the cloud company, you know, the underbelly is a data center, you know, which is where all computing resides and they operate their, you know, operations business from there. Everything is becoming pure software as well, and it's all running on commodity servers. So basically, what used to be specialized hardware doing one thing and one thing only is now becoming pure software running on commodity servers. And that is something that started to happen in the web scale world. You know, if you look at any of these consumer cloud companies,
Amazon,
Google, Facebook, and so on, that technology where they said, look, the only way to reduce our OPEX spend and operational expenditure spend, and also to make things highly automated, the fact that we get economies of scale is to reduce the number of people required to operate a million servers. So they had to really look at standardizing hardware and putting everything in pure software. And that's how infrastructure has become code, because it's imminently programmable to rack and stack a new device without having to go physically be in a data center. Similar to installing an app on your iPhone in some sense.
You kind of tend to forget about the infrastructure and just concentrate on the application layers.
Absolutely. So I think that's what's happening in the space of enterprise computing. You know, we call it enterprise cloud operating system. You know, the idea of an operating system, obviously every 10 years we see a couple of operating systems emerge as the consumption model keeps changing. You know, in the 80s we went from mainframe to client server, and there was a couple of operating systems like HP UX and AIX from IBM that emerged. In the 90s, it again the server became smaller, so it came to Solaris, which is Sun Microsystems, and and Windows, which owed to the Intel paradigm shift. And then in the 2000s, there was Linux and VMware. And in the last 5-7 years, we've seen Amazon as an operating system for the cloud. So we think that there is a need to really balance owning and renting, because, you know, computing is going through a big transition. Elements of e-commerce are now merging with computing. Just the way you could buy any goods on an e-commerce site, you could go and buy computing through a credit card. So there's a big disruption happening in the space of computing.
So you're essentially in Nutanix. What you do, correct me if I'm wrong, is replacing the data, the infrastructure that a company might have used to have shelves upon shelves of infrastructure for data centers, and replacing that with a more, let's say, standardized hardware
with software on top. So
is it a cloud solution which is considered private, I mean custom for a company, or a more public?
It's changing.
Cloud?
I think, you know, if you think of the continuum of consumption when it comes to, let's say, cars, you know, you could do an Uber for an hour, you could you do a car rental for 3 days. You could
lease. Car as a service.
Exactly. Yeah. So
you don't own it.
Well, and many a time people, if they want to keep it for three to five years, they have to own the car. So in our own lives, we end up renting, we end up Ubering, we end up leasing, and we end up owning cars as well. And that's what computing is going to go through as well. It's going to be all forms of consumption. You know, sometimes you want to rent, sometimes you want to own. So private and public are here to stay together as one. Mm. The question is, can you make them look like one? You know, I think, and this is a big computer science challenge to say, can you take the application and have it float around, make it portable enough where it can sometimes run in your data centers, which is called a private cloud, or sometimes run in someone else's data center, which is a public cloud. And that's
so
the
Nutanix
big...
So Nutanix does both? Both
that's what
private
the,
and public clouds?
Last 8 years, we have focused a lot on private cloud. You know, the idea of building that iPhone-like architecture for the private cloud, which is... extremely software defined and software based. But now in the coming 5 years, you'll see us really go and figure out a way to blur the lines between owning and renting, where you could move the applications back and forth between private and public.
There are also great problems associated with, for example, public cloud. We'll talk about private clouds in a minute, but public clouds, for example, for companies, let's say for a company, it's control of its data. And the infrastructure, it can be imperative. You don't want to be in a position where you are locked to a specific vendor, be it Nutanix or maybe Amazon or Google, whatever, because then you kind of place the crown jewels of the company in a third party's hands, and you can't really control it anymore.
Yeah, I think, and the good thing is that as a company, we are not taking any sides. You know, because once you take sides, you realize that you become a stagnant company. Like in the 90s, people were taking sides against Intel. You're like, oh, it's a toy. It's only good for PCs. How can they ever come into data centers and, you know, run servers when servers are supposed to $1 million equipment? How can you have a $5,000 server? Same thing, people were trying to take sides a decade ago with virtualization, which is a big disruption that happened in our industry, where servers are not even visible anymore. They're pure software. You know, servers became invisible, and a lot of companies are taking sides on, you know, virtualization is going to be a toy, you can't use it for more serious things. And I think the winds of change eventually change some of this perception around what could go into the public cloud and what could stay on-prem. The important thing is that you have to balance both. And you need to have a piece of software that basically says, I don't take sides. You can basically run it on both sides. And the important thing is I can give you the flexibility of moving back and forth. Because
so you don't try to, I mean, if I'm a CEO of a company, a potential client, you don't try to argue with what I'm saying. You're saying, you know what, I'll give you the flexibility to decide if you want to have a private cloud, you control your own data, or the public cloud, which
exactly
has its own advantages.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, the analogy there is everybody talks about driverless cars, which are fully autonomous. But in today's world, it's hard to actually have fully autonomous cars because machines, if they're dealing with other machines, they can be intelligent. But if the machines are dealing with humans, you're in a hybrid world where enough cars are not autonomous and enough cars are still driven by people.
It's not so, the factory floor.
Exactly.
It's
that's not why, controlled. That's why you have to have a semi-autonomous world. This is what hybrid cloud is. The idea of hybrid is that you don't really focus on one or the other. You're saying, how can both coexist? And this is where Nutanix is operating
this
system.
Kind of compromise, doesn't it compromise, doesn't it bring compromise also in terms of, for example, performance and cost? Because private clouds, you'd get the best performance, but it will be more costly. And if you shift towards a more public cloud stand, then you'll get maybe less performance, for example. What do you say to customers about that?
Well, I don't think it's either or. You can get performance from both. You can get economics from both. Depends on the kind of use cases. Like I'm in Israel, Tel Aviv for 3 nights. I'm not going to lease an apartment. I'm not going to own a home. I'm going to rent a hotel because it's a bursty requirement. I'm here for 3 nights alone. Now, if I come here for 6 months, I'm not going to rent a hotel. That's public cloud-like, you know, because public cloud is a rented model. I'm going to lease an apartment. And if I stay here for 3 years, I'm going to probably buy a home and resell it. So it all depends on how elastic, how bursty your demand is. You know, the moment it becomes predictable, it's cheaper to own than to rent. Same thing with cars or whatever else that you actually want to rent together. So I think economics can work both ways. Performance can be made to work both ways. It's this idea that at some applications and some workloads are so predictable, and obviously they might have data sovereignty and ownership and compliance and regulation requirements that they can't leave the private cloud itself. But the many other applications where you could actually say, look, as long as the service provider, the cloud service provider, is willing to prove to me that the data is protected and I have the encryption keys, we can actually work both ways. So I think the industry is going through a big transition. The good thing is that unlike buying a toothpaste or a mouthwash, software is way more complicated. And the SLAs of computing will be more profound than, let's say, power or utility or something, or water. You know, water and power have very easy ways to explain, you know, like what kind of SLAs you need. It's amperes and it's voltage. Software is way more complicated. Every 5 years, we are expecting more from software. We expect more from machines.
It's a difficult field.
It's way more. You can't just say it's going to be all utility. That's a dumb way of saying that. Look, we know exactly what software looks like today. Because obviously, every 5 years, it's surprising us what software can actually do.
What about vendor lock? How do you approach the concern of clients who say, I don't want to be maybe locked with Nutanix. I don't know if you're going to survive in 10 to 15 years, maybe. You know, greater companies have crashed in a shorter period of time.
I think,
how do
you know,
approach those concerns?
So, you know, computer science, we talk about abstraction. The word abstraction is pretty popular. Or you can even use the word virtualization, or sometimes use the word proxy or indirection and things like that. Basically, anytime something becomes too important, you put a level of indirection where it's no more an end in itself, but a means to an end. Because when technology begins, it becomes an end in itself. It becomes a part of the strategy. Like virtualization 10 years ago was a strategy for a CIO. Now it's a means to an end because, you know, it basically is a vehicle to get cloud computing possible or something. So what we believe in is this idea of portability or mobility, actually, is very important. If you go back to our personal lives again, until we had number portability, operators were too strong and powerful. because they could charge whatever they wanted.
We're talking cell phone numbers and telephone numbers,
exactly,
for example.
Exactly, yeah. So once you got cell phone number portability, then the power came back to the buyer, no more with this service provider. And I think that's what computing is going through, where applications need to be portable and mobile. And it can be done if you put a layer of abstraction, or a layer of software that basically says, let me not hard code my APIs and my implementation to one cloud provider. Let me see if I can actually use, and this is where Google and Nutanix are going to do something together. We announced a big partnership about 4 weeks ago about how do you put this layer of abstraction so that applications can actually be mobile. You know, so we'll work pretty closely with the open source API that Google has.
But actually, Nutanix and Google can be looked on as kind of enemies in this shared market. I mean, both are competing in the same field, no?
So they are coming from a consumer cloud experience. They have made huge innovation sort of progress in the last 15 years in the world of computing and machine intelligence and machine learning and AI and things like that. Obviously transformed our lives with their innovation and R&D.
But I totally live and die on Google's platform. I mean,
yeah. But at the same time, I think enterprise computing is new to them, which is something that we have been doing for the last 8 years. So what does it mean to really meld private clouds and public clouds is an area that both of us are very curious about, very intrigued about, and we'd love to actually go and do something that is going to be as simple as a search box of Google, because again, Google was not just a backend company doing, you know, tons of machine learning and AI with millions of servers, but also a really simple and elegant front-end company where they don't have any ads on the search box, you know, around the search box. And the search box is intelligent, and it does auto-completes, and it knows what you're going to type and things like that. So there's a lot of user interface challenges to face in this idea of hybrid cloud itself that together we believe we can work on.
How was this cooperation born? I mean, Google is a company, I guess millions of other companies in the world would love to cooperate with Google. How did this cooperation was started?
Well, I think they saw us as a company that was willing to innovate, willing to be bold and courageous, because you know,
did they approach you personally, or was it the other way around?
I think it's many a time it's both ways. You know, it's like, you know, because we were also looking at the renting owning model, how they'll come together, and they were also looking at renting owning model and how they'll come together. And sometimes it's just happenstance, you know, just through people in the middle and stuff, and obviously media, and I mean, things of the nature that we're doing right now with you in the podcast, you know, people listen, they're like, hey, and then
everyday interactions.
Yeah. And, you know, business is about exploring the unthinkable, you know, that's what, you know, and business is about explorers. Business is about saying, let's not say no right away. Let's figure out what it means to at least talk it out. Let's figure out the process of getting to know each other. And that's how, you know, any kind of collaboration, cooperation begins.
Are there any dangers in collaborating with big companies such as Google? I mean, they are bigger, stronger in the market. Isn't there some sort of a danger sometimes with collaborating with such a huge entity?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be self-assured when you're doing these things. I mean, it's always easy to say, well, intellectual property and what if people can copy? I mean, you have to be confident that whatever you're doing is difficult enough and profound enough that it cannot just be easily copied. You know, what we do at Nutanix is a combination of a lot of backend work, which is systems and design and architecture, scalability, reliability of systems, but also front end of human computer interaction. What does it mean to make things extremely simple and invisible and one click? And a lot of those things are not copyable. You know, the idea of design, I mean, like, why wouldn't any sort of a cheaper cell phone company copy everything Apple does? It's difficult because design is in the DNA of Apple, just like automation is in the DNA of Amazon, and scale is the DNA of Google. So there are things that these companies do that is basically innate in the way they live their lives every day, and these things are hard to copy.
What's in the DNA of Nutanix?
You know, we're trying to really sort of combine the trifecta. I named the three companies: Apple's design mentality. You know, how do you reduce friction between people and machines, you know, humans and machines, where you have to be opinionated. We use the word opinionated design, you know, so you have to be opinionated about the 80% of the users.
You have to make decisions for the customer, for the client. Exactly. And restricting maybe
options
for the client.
And that's
which, by the way, pisses off lots of other customers, yeah. Right? I mean, I would never, for example, use iPhone because I like to be, I like my opinion to count, exactly. Not maybe Apple's
yeah.
designer.
Yeah. So you said something which is important for B2B because obviously we're in the enterprise space, so we have to keep it more flexible, but at least you understand what opinionated design means for the Pareto principle, 80-20. Well, 80% of the people want the software vendor to make a call and not just come out, blurt out like 50 options that you're like, well, I don't even know how to choose. So that's Apple. Obviously, Amazon has done an amazing job of managing warehouses and bringing that warehouse grade automation to computing. It's just everything is automated and that's how you gain scale. So we're learning a lot from Amazon there. And then finally, learning about scale from Google. What does it mean to be web scale? What does it mean to be using commodity servers? What does it mean to be never thinking about bottlenecks and performance issues and things like that? I mean, they've built their entire DNA around latency. Where it says, look, if you can solve latency, you know, how you can return query response times, the search response times in less than 100 milliseconds or 10 milliseconds and things like that. So there's a lot to learn from all these three companies. And the question is, can we actually really combine these three and become a unique company of our own?
And you keep returning on, you keep saying the word learning and learning and learning. And we all know that high tech and technology in general is a field where you have to learn all the time. And I get the sense of from what I read about you that I would say that you're a kind of a philosopher king, if we give an analogy for ancient times. And you try to learn a lot, and even you describe yourself in LinkedIn as a beachcomber of people experiences. You try to learn all the time. Why where does the need to learn all the time comes from? Is it from your childhood, your
yeah,
family,
yeah.
or anything else?
Well, I come from a pretty, challenging background. You know, obviously, went through
English. You were born in India.
Born in India for the first 22 years. I lived in India. So in 1997, I moved to the US. But I've always been vulnerable about things, you know, because it didn't come easy to us. Life was not easy.
Tell me a bit about your childhood. What do you mean when you say it wasn't easy?
So I was born and raised in the most lawless part of India, you know, the poorest state, the most corrupt state.
Which is?
Bihar, B-I-H-A-R. And I think it probably was a renaissance state 50 years ago, 80 years ago. They were always politically conscious people who went on to become the first president and many prime ministers. So they actually had some real scholarly people in the early days. And then politics was, so the student body was politicized and corruption really came in a big way. So that's just the waxing and waning of any civilization. I think in the last 100 years, that state really went to the dogs. And it was very hard for my father, you know, who used to be a government doctor, to even get salaries on time, you know. So they would not get salaries for 6 months to a year and so on, you know. And my mom had to do a lot. She's a real iron lady, I would say, you know, sold a lot for personal jewelry to send us to English medium schools, which were not expensive from Indian standards. And at an age of 18, I went to do my undergrad from one of the IITs, you know, they call Indian Institutes of Technology. I studied computer science, and even there, even though the college fees were relatively inexpensive, it was still a lot for my family, actually, you know.
Did you have many brothers and sisters?
We were just two siblings, my brother and I. But I mean, just being in the capital city of that state was expensive enough when you're not getting salaries and stuff like that, you know. So I think we've seen a lot in terms of adversity, and my extended family has helped us a lot. So there's a lot that I've seen in life to know that nothing comes easy, and what comes to you can also go away. It's going to be pretty ephemeral.
But you know that sometimes with that background, many people go the other way. They don't go to learn and try to get education and keep being a lifelong learner, but they go and find work and try maybe to have stronger economic foundation in life. And you kind of went the other way in life. You chose to be a student and then immigrated to the U.S. Where does that come from? Yeah.
I think I've been learning this word, vulnerability. It's a very, very powerful word, actually. Vulnerability is probably the most powerful word that I would love to embrace. And being vulnerable is a very paradoxical thing. Like, well, are you saying that you want to be weak? Because vulnerability has at least a denotation of being weak.
Especially in the business world.
Exactly. And I think that it actually makes you stronger. You know, and I've been reading a lot. We have an advisor. We just signed up another advisor on this idea of how to celebrate vulnerability and how vulnerability drives courage. So one of our advisors, Mike Robbins, who talks about authenticity, like what does it mean to be authentic as a person, as a business, as a manager, as an entrepreneur, and so on. And he actually has a formula that, look, if you look at a spectrum, it goes from dishonest, phony people on the left to honest people in the middle, which means that honesty is not good enough. You have to take something out of honesty and add something to honesty to make it authentic. And he says you got to take out self-righteousness from honesty and add vulnerability to honesty to make it authentic. And it's really powerful to think of how you have to add vulnerability to make something authentic. As a company, I think we're learning to be less self-righteous. As a company, we're learning to be more vulnerable and yet derive courage from it. In fact, one of the other people that I really respect a lot, she's one of the best TED speakers. You know, her name is Brené Brown. She's a professor at University of Houston, and she researches vulnerability. That's her only topic of research, is and how that helps drive courage and how do you use that to build brave companies and brave people and brave entrepreneurs and managers and so on. So
how do you implement vulnerability in terms of a company? I mean, being vulnerable in a world where you're competing against Amazon and Google and all the stuff, all the other companies, it's not something that you'll have an easy time convincing me that a company needs.
Mm. Well, I think day-to-day discourse, like let's say an engineer has to write a design document or a product manager has to write a product requirements document, they have to eventually go and this happens in research and academia. When you look at research papers, there's a lot of sections they leave for future research, design trade-offs. All they're trying to say is that we don't know enough. There's enough things that are left for future, and there's enough things that we took trade-offs on and things like that. So you have to have those things on your day-to-day discourses where you actually help with your idea by talking about how it's weak in some other areas, because it then settles down people. They're like, look, they're not trying to say they have the best idea. What they're saying is that they have a really good idea, but it has taken some design trade-offs, made some design trade-offs. And these are things, the use cases or workloads or applications where it does not apply and so on. So I think it basically happens. I mean, even in like media and communications and press releases, I hate it when somebody says we are the market leader. I'm like, who made us the market leader? We are self-proclaimed in some sense, So there's some very cliched words that even in marketing and communications people use that just is the opposite of what powerful marketing means, actually. And if you were to instead say, look, we are trying and we don't know whether we'll succeed or fail in your communications, people consider you to be more trusting. They're like, yeah, I can believe that because, nothing is perfect.
Or it can create the other effect of maybe, there's a saying, fake it till you make it. And maybe, you don't know all the trade-offs, you don't know the perfect route, but you can maybe pretend to know that. So you gain the trust of people who are maybe less assured of themselves. I mean, you mentioned Apple before. It was a very well-known trait of Steve Jobs to assume that he knows best what's good for the customer. Even though I'm sure that he had his thoughts, maybe I'm not too sure. But at least outwardly, he did say, I know what people want, and that maybe what's the secret of his success.
You're
going the opposite route.
I have a variant of his ideology. The variant is that don't ask the customer for version 1.0 of a product. Because, you know, it's like going back to Henry Ford saying, if you ask the customer, they'll say, give me faster horses. They wouldn't know what a car meant. So going from version 0.1 through version 1.0, you have to have opinions. Now you have to relax it going from 1.0 to 1.1 because now the customer is going to give you inputs and feedbacks and enhancements.
You don't want to fall in love with your opinion.
Exactly. So you have to relax opinions in 1.1 and 1.2. And then again in 2.0, you need to have your opinions. So there's a give and take that happens when you're doing product development, business development, where the waxing and waning of when to assert your opinion, when to relax your opinion, is how you negotiate with the marketplace. And that is what Steve Jobs did. I mean, look, stylus, he hated it. He's like, never in my life can we have a stylus. And eventually they had stylus. I mean, iTunes on Windows. He said, there's no way I can have an iTunes application on Windows. Yeah. And then he had it because as part of kind of bending backwards for the market, for the realities of Windows versus Mac in those days of 2006 and 7, it was the right thing to do. So there's a lot of things, copy and paste. There's a lot of things that Apple has actually done. I mean, even if you think of Apple 1.0 in the 80s, it was about closed systems, our stack and yes, nothing else, right? And when he went on to do next computing, it was very similar. When Microsoft was opening up everything through APIs and flexibility, configurability, partners, ecosystem, marketplaces, that's how Microsoft defined computing, right? Now, when he comes back in his 2.0, which is 97 and beyond, he was more vulnerable. He's like, look, I know that there are lessons to be learned from Microsoft, and how I was doing it wrong in even at Next and before that in Apple 1.0 itself, you know. So iTunes, Marketplace, App Store, all these things were learnings that he's had in those 20 years before he actually rebooted Apple one more time.
Osim Asakim, Imran Levy.
That brings us back to the business of learning all the time, learning from either books and mentors or learning from your customers and not falling in love with what you think you know best. Mm-hmm. You think that kind of attitude that you grew over the years, is it ingrained in something that you took from the Hindi culture that you brought to the U.S.? I mean, you didn't grow up in the U.S., so you by definition almost, you bring something else to the table. Mm-hmm. Is it something that came with you from the culture in India?
Yeah, maybe something. Obviously, it's subconscious. You know, I can't pinpoint what. It's probably family and personal and some part of the culture in which I grew up. Basically, it's about nothing comes for free and it can very easily go away as well. So keep learning because, and especially in our own, the marketplace that we operate in, is a red ocean, actually. There's tons of sharks out there. It's a bloody ocean.
As opposed to a blue ocean where you have lots of opportunities and you can choose anything. Mm. Red ocean, yeah, is kind of bloody ocean. Yeah. You have
and it's to a, take it's care. It's a much larger ocean than the blue ocean. Blue is a smaller ocean. And I think as a company, for us to embrace being authentic and keep learning, and that's what innovative companies do. There's a really good book that I read recently about a year and a half ago. It's called The Founder's Mentality. It's from the Harvard Press. And a couple of these Bain consultants who actually wrote a book. And they talk about a problem statement that, look, when companies are early and young, they're insurgents, they're like constantly trying to go and disrupt the status quo. And then over time, they start to get arrogant. And then they start to take the balance of power tilted towards themselves versus the customer. And
then they lose the founder mentality?
Exactly. So and then the problem statement is very simple. It's very elegant as well, the way they put it. They're like, all you wanted was growth. But growth created complexity. And complexity is a silent killer of growth. So what you wanted is what will kill you. It's a really profound paradox in business. So they talk about like what does it mean to keep sustaining it? Because very few companies sustain growth. I mean, most of S&P...
And Nutanix grew from being, I mean, starting in 2009 to what, 2,800 employees in just under 8 years.
Yeah, it's amazing growth. And all of this could vanish if we didn't stay authentic and didn't stay vulnerable and didn't keep learning. So I think they have this recipe they talk about, because obviously look at companies that have vanished. I mean, S&P 500, which is an index in the US, I mean, every 5 years, a big percentage of them just go away from S&P 500 simply because they're being disrupted in a big way. So they talk about three things. The first one is, how do you continue to celebrate insurgency, which is people who want to go and break this status quo? The second one is owner's mindset. You know, what does it mean for managers and business professionals to have this idea of delight and waste? You know, think about delight for your customers and your employees and your partners, and figuring out what it means to understand waste, because as you become way bigger, waste increases as well. And the last thing is obsession for the frontline, and this idea that, you know, you have an obsession for your end customer is very, very important. So as a company, we are obsessed with the frontline. We are not a perfect company, you know, but together technology and customer service makes us close to being perfect, you know, because tech will never be perfect. There'll always be issues with products and things like that. The question is, how do you become a brand where customer service is celebrated? So we have done a lot of good work in just understanding customer service, you know, putting a bunch of analytics about how customers look at us and so on. And together between tech and customer service, we can really build a company that could be long-lasting.
I understand how you can maybe imbue these qualities in a small company. But when a company grows at such a rapid rate for a short period of time, you as a CEO are no longer close to the front line yourself. You're not dealing with customers. And how do you teach the other employees in the company, who will later on need to teach the next generation of employees, to have those qualities, for example?
Well, you need to simplify cultural values, like the values of the company. We talk about three H's, you know. Three is important because three is like trilogy, trifecta, triumvirate, trio. So three is
a fundamental number.
Yeah, just a fundamental number. So you talk about three. So we talk about hungry, humble, honest. You know, how can you stay hungry? How can you stay humble? And how can you stay honest? Now, we're not very humble with our competitors, but it's okay. I think we are at war, and we have to understand that it's more important to be vulnerable and humble with our customers and our employees and our partners. So you have to simplify some of these sort of cultural values and go and figure out where to disseminate it. I have four A's that I keep thinking about every time, and hopefully we can do more of these going forward with our employees too. Ambition, you know, very important to have ambition. And then how do you really make it realistic with attention to detail? So ambition and attention to detail go hand in hand, you know. One without the other is weak. One is the big picture, one is the small picture, and both big picture and small picture always on an everyday basis. You have to say, is the big picture landing well or not? You know, and that can only come if you have attention to detail. And then, of course, I talked about authenticity, and the last one is anti-fragile. You know, it's one of my
anti-fragile.
Yeah, in fact, a very famous author who I'm trying to learn from is Nicholas Nassim Taleb. You know, he's written, as you know, books like Fooled by Randomness and Black Swan, and most recently Anti-Fragile. I think our company has gone through a ton of shocks. I mean, we've had two or three near-death experiences in the last 8 years. And
what do you mean by near-death experiences?
You know, sometimes the product assumptions were wrong. And sometimes we were too callous about hardware, like, you know, oh yeah, we are a software company, you know, commodity hardware should just work off the shelf. So things that we did in execution, or things that we were thinking about design assumptions, were wrong, and they could have very easily stalled and the company actually.
And you started losing customers, etc.
Well, it was in the early days, you know, and some things happened with one of our partners who became a competitor of us over time, and how they were treating us, very similar to the way how Apple was treating Microsoft in the 80s. because, you know, Microsoft was not in the operating systems business. They were building apps for Apple, yeah, and
Office
others.
And such.
Yeah, and then the treatment they got from Apple is like, look, we got to take control of our destiny, and they said, we'll build an operating system, which was extremely shocking to Apple back in the day. Or even what happened with Google and Apple with Google Maps and stuff like that, actually, you know, on iOS. So I think... the fact that we had to take control of our destiny about 4 or 5 years ago to build our full stack, because we were not a full stack platform before that.
Meaning you had, I mean, hardware was assigned to a third party?
More than hardware, I think we're building a couple of these apps that were running on someone else's operating system. It was VMware's operating system or Microsoft's operating system. And then we said we got to build our own operating system, you know. And, you know, I think these were days when we felt cornered and felt like... we were vulnerable, but that vulnerability gave us courage to go and say the world needs yet another operating system. Because for a small company to even dream that they can build an operating system is laughable. It's preposterous to say, yes. Like, what? I mean, there is VMware, there's Microsoft, there is Amazon. Are you kidding me? So I think the fact that we built our own operating system over time and it continues to look elegant and beautiful and scalable and reliable... most of the world can't even give us the benefit of the doubt yet, but every year is a new year. I think when you said...
lots of companies who built their own operating system failed. Nokia had its own operating system for smartphones that failed. Samsung is failing with Tizen, and yet you took the plunge. Yeah, and
I mean, it's a tougher road, and I wrote a pretty good... well, I shouldn't call it pretty good myself, but I wrote an article...
you can, nobody's here.
No. I wrote an article in our .next magazine. You know, we have a user conference in which we started doing a magazine recently. And it says on operating systems and Darwinism, you know, so survival of the fittest and what happens along the way. What are the three values of an operating system that you need to have? And one is ubiquity. It has to be ubiquitous. So we are making our operating system run on everybody's hardware, not just our own appliance, but everybody's hardware. You know, as we go and do this with Google, we just made an announcement at Google that our operating system will run in Google's cloud platform in their data centers and stuff. So we are making our software work on IBM's hardware and obviously all of Intel's hardware. So ubiquity is very important for an operating system. And Nokia was not thinking about ubiquity. Right. Yeah. The second one is ease of use. You know, you have to make it really, really, really simple. I mean, the reason why Sun Microsystems Solaris operating system didn't survive, or even Digital Equipment Corporation's operating system didn't survive, because it's not the easiest to use compared to Windows and so on. And the last one is APIs, you know, ecosystem and partners and how you look at yourself as a big puzzle piece when other puzzle pieces have to fit together. And that's where APIs matter and ecosystem matters and app stores matter and configurability of the system matters. And so I think if these three traits don't exist, you cannot dream to build an operating system. So we're hustling very hard to make our stuff ubiquitous. We're hustling very hard to make our stuff really, really easy to use, you know, like really raise the bar on usability and ease of use and such, simplicity. And lastly, about building an ecosystem around us with APIs.
Let's go back to your beginning as a young PhD student in the US at age 22. And by the way, your resume, your CV in LinkedIn and other places, you kind of proudly state that you're a PhD dropout. Now, that's an interesting way to present yourself to the world in LinkedIn or Twitter, whatever. PhD dropout. You know, once upon a time, people who dropped out of PhDs maybe tended to push that fact a bit, make it a bit less obvious in the CV. Why did you decide to put it publicly?
Well, you know, maybe, and it's obviously subconscious, you know, but maybe I'm a closet academician, you know. I think I always wanted to stay close to computer science, and in 98, I went to intern at Oracle. And this was the height of the bubble, you know, the big internet bubble. So this was my first summer. And obviously, a year before, I had taken my first flight in life. Because in 97, when I came from India to the US, I had never flown before, you know. So, I mean, coming from humble beginnings, and then within a year, I see how big the internet bubble was and how the industry was really disruptive, I said, look, I got to at least go on a leave of absence because this is the time to be in the industry, not so be in academia.
You chose to drop out of PhD. Yeah, maybe that's why you're so proud of a decision that went out well.
Well, I went on leave of absence for a couple of years, and UT, University of Texas, Austin, kept pushing it for 2 years. But I mean, the good thing that what I'm proud about is that I was a direct admit to the PhD program. So I didn't have to go through quals and things like that, which I was a fellow of the department, which I feel proud about. But and the reason why I believe today Nutanix is where it is because I continue to stay close to computer science. You know, even though I'm a business person now and I'm supposed to go just do selling and marketing and things like that, staying close to the product, staying close to what's happening in the industry, being as big a nerd as what Google would expect a partner to be, these are important things for me. You know, understanding design, the philosophy of what does it mean to actually have opinions in design and things like that. I'm pretty close to the product, and I think the reason is because probably I'm a closet product person who has actually always dealt with products and things like that. And I believe in reducing friction. You know, one of the things that I always think about is reducing friction, and not just between humans and machines, but between machines and machines, because APIs matter. And if machines can't talk to machines, then you don't have a scalable system. And then finally, people to people, human to human interaction is a lot of reducing friction as well. So I think maybe that's where a lot of the pride comes, that look, I think I understand at least the importance of reducing friction between humans and machines, machines and machines, and humans. But it's hard to answer why I would be proud about the fact that it dropped out. I mean, I feel good that I made a wise choice about the timing.
How difficult was that choice?
I would say not in the first year, but the second year when I said, wow, I'm going to lose my PhD admission, I think it probably became one of those.
When it becomes permanent, that's where.
Yeah, exactly. And then I have difficult. To reapply and stuff, you know. But I'm very well connected to UT right now, University of Texas CS program. You know, I'm back to trying to figure out how to influence the UTCS program, because computer science programs around the world are changing in a big way. And I'd love to contribute in whatever ways I could to UTCS, you know.
Let me take you a bit to, let's say, a higher sphere. Lots of Indian and Chinese and lots of Israelis, engineers working on Silicon Valley. Yet Trump's administration is trying persistently to cut the numbers of engineers coming to the U.S. What do you think about that? I mean, will it harm Silicon Valley and the high-tech industry in the long run? Or will it do the opposite, maybe? Maybe it will make the U.S. itself stronger and self-sufficient and create a better environment for, let's say, improving education, for example. Mm.
Well, two things. One is for the students themselves. I think they need to, you know, there's a very good book that probably is one of my favorite books in life. It's called Only the Paranoid Survive by Andy Grove.
From Intel.
Yeah. I'd love for the audience to at least read that book. It talks about the history of Intel and resilience and anti-fragility. And the last chapter that he added in the later editions was called How You Are the CEO of Your Own Career. You know, and paranoia matters, and you need to really go and shape it independent of what the external factors are and so on. So in this case, in talking about immigration, you need to have a plan B, period. You need to know that you will join a company which probably, if you don't get a visa for the first couple of years, you could work out of Vancouver or Tel Aviv or Berlin or Bangalore or Shanghai, a place like that. So you need to have that plan B figured out, because these things happen. When right after I joined the industry, within 2 years, the bubble burst. Massive.
Yes, I remember that massive. Period. And I was a student myself.
You have to navigate. You have to understand what it means to be anti-fragile and what it means to learn from shocks and stuff. So if you get a visa denied, figure it out, because the world owes you nothing. Actually, that's the way I would think about students. Now, for the U.S., I think it's noise. I mean, eventually it'll die down. The good sense prevails. I look at U.S. as a highly resilient democracy. Obviously, there is a little bit of waxing and waning of emotions about, you know, doing things in America versus doing outside. There's some balance of trade issues with China and stuff like that. I mean, these things have happened forever. You know, like 30 years ago, it was with Japan. I mean, if you remember, import of cars from Japan was a big deal. And the most profound thing about the U.S. is that it is, as a democracy, it knows how to recover from its own mistakes. And we've had a fair share of mistakes in the U.S. that we've committed in the last 100 years. But we are not a perfect society, far from perfect, actually. You know, think about, you know, how we abolished segregation only in 1964, and when women's suffrage was 1920, which is like, you know, as late as 1920, yeah. You know, women are not allowed to vote. So I think, you know, I firmly believe in the resilience of the U.S. society, and I believe that immigration kind of issues will sort of solve for themselves in the coming year or two, I think, you know.
So in a sense, you're saying we have Trump now, we have a president in who knows how many years from now, another president, but still the march of progress in that sense, the U.S., if I understand correctly, you're saying the U.S. can't really be segregated from the rest of the world. They'll still need to be the march of progress in terms of globalization, etc. So it's just noise. Ignore that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, if democracy weakens and if the melting pot experiment were to stall, like, you know, Silicon Valley is a melting pot. And the diversity of the gene pool is what makes it so powerful. The diversity of the gene pool in universities and the academics who actually come and do research there, that's what makes it so powerful. It's the gene pool that makes America great, actually, you know. So if it starts to stall, there'll be reasons to worry. But, I mean, business friendliness and capitalism, they all have their own little ways of saying we need more talent from the outside, and that's the only way we can be competitive and so on. So I think in that sense, even what we are seeing in today's days and age of decisions that President Trump is making, a lot of it is because businesses are telling him what to do and what not to do as well. And I think that's the checks and balance you need. There's part of it is strategy, which is political, and part of it is strategy that's just pure business. And you have to balance the two, actually, you know.
Okay, two final questions. First, you achieved something that I guess, looking back at being a child, looking back at your childhood in India, is amazing. You reached an amazing height. What's forward for you personally? Is there any next peak that you think you want to maybe conquer?
Well, for one, I'll say that I don't think I've achieved much because of how... I mean, I look at life as a marathon, and what has changed is that it used to be that you'd pace your marathon 10, 15, 20 years ago. Now it's a marathon of sprints. You know, you have to keep every quarter, every 6 months, every year is like a sprint, and you have to figure out how to just take a deep breath after every sprint and so on. The sprint of this company, the sprint of my career is to see if we can really build an operating system that is long-lasting. We're in the very early stages of that operating system. We have hustled to make it ubiquitous, but there's so much work to be done with the software that we're building, with how we need to change lives. I mean, we've probably built 100-odd millionaires or more, maybe a couple of hundred, but we need to create wealth for people. We need to create, you know, build careers for people. We need for people to go back and say, wow, I worked at Nutanix. And in that sense, we are still way too early, and I feel like we've accomplished nothing. So there's a lot of giants to look up to and learn from them. I talk about Apple, I talk about Amazon, I talk about Google. I think these are the companies that I'd love to actually emulate and learn from. So it's very early days. I mean, I read a lot of books. As I mentioned to you before, there's some, you know, great mentors and authors who have become advisors to the company that I learn from. I think when I read those things, and recently at our .next user conference, we had Mick Ebling, who is a CEO of a company called Not Impossible, come and present. And he talks about giving and how he melded his passion for technology with giving, philanthropy, and things like that. So that's an area that I've barely scratched the surface of, you know, because I'm so busy trying to build a business that I don't think I've done justice to this idea of giving. So I hope my wife and I and our children, we can actually learn to respect, because I got a lot from the world, you know. I think I couldn't have been here without, let's say, University of Texas's fellowship, you know, or IIT's, government actually sponsored the entire world-class education when I was in India, or my extended family. So I feel like...
You want to give back.
I have to give back. And the things that we have to do in the future that will make me more complete than what I am today.
In, you know, in what field you want to give back, in a specific sense?
Yeah, I have two daughters, you know, they're twins. And I think about how I meld some of the things that, so, you know, women in tech, for example, you know, how do you get more women in technology is increasingly becoming a personal goal for me, because I look at my daughters, I'm like, they have to be great at, and then tech being computer science for me, because, you know, that's another passion area. So can I get these things to come together? So women in computer science, you know, doing PhDs and things like that would be areas where I'd love to actually go and, you know, get some things out of some of these universities that I look up to and so on. So I think there are things that I want to do, but again, these are things that make me realize how incomplete I am. And for the listeners, I would love for you to go and look at Mick Ebling, M-I-C-K, Ebling, E-B-E-L-I-N-G. And it's moving when he talks in conferences. I mean, we had a standing ovation come from 4,000 people who basically said, this is the best part of the conference, of how you learn about how incomplete you are. That's what I really want to do in the future. Now, I think how we weave all that in today is also equally important. You know?
Okay, so we have time for one last small question. You mentioned lots of books. One particular one that maybe influenced you at a younger age that you recommend to our listeners?
Only the Paranoid Survive, you know, is Andy probably Grove. The book, Andy Grove.
Yeah.
And most recently, in the last 3-4 years, Deepak Malhotra, who is my mentor and advisor from Harvard Business School. He teaches negotiation at Harvard. So he's his books are really good as well. The latest one is Negotiating the Impossible.
Negotiating the Impossible.
The Impossible, yes. Yeah. And it basically is about how negotiation is about empathy, about framing, about process before substance. A lot of good things he talks about. And just, you know, a few sentences that he said that have really sort of made a mark in my life is, time reveals all truth. Like, these are profound statements, actually, you know. Or, you know, what's not negotiable today can be made negotiable tomorrow if you understood the process, you know. So the word process is important. So lots of good things in that book. Obviously, I've mentioned some other books from my advisors. But yeah, have advisors, read books.
Learn.
Absolutely.
Diraj, thank you very much. It's been an honor, a great a pleasure to talking to you. To our listeners, I remind you that our website is www.ranlevi.com/biz. You'll find all of our previous interviews there. You can find us on Facebook. We have a group, we have a page of the network, the Making History Network. And we are on iPhone with Osim Asakim. And we have an Android app as well. We're everywhere. Thank you very much, Diraj. Been a pleasure. Goodbye.
Pleasure. Thank you.